So welcome, Chris and John, to Christy Walk. You some time ago owned a property here, didn't you?
You did indeed.
Yeah.
And it's been a nice connection still with
absolutely,
Christy Walk.
Absolutely. And it's on ceded Kaurna land. And I'd like you to both introduce yourselves and say what you do, basically.
Well, my name's Chris Bryant, and I'm sort of got a permaculture background. But I've also, in the past, did environmental science. I try now to be still permaculture, but I don't do any classes. But I encourage where I can to promote the permaculture cause. Where we live in a suburban block in Felixstowe, we grow a third of our food, and we have 90 productive trees on that block. But being very dry this summer, it's been really a lot of work to keep maintain that property.
I'm John Boland, Emeritus Professor of Environmental Mathematics at the University of South Australia. And I love applying mathematical and statistical techniques to environmental issues like electricity from renewables, in particular, water resource management, environmental accounting, and a place that's often disregarded in the general discussion about energy and electricity, energy-efficient building design. Because it's not sexy, you're not sort of opening big wind or solar farms, people neglect that demand side aspect. So I like looking at that as well.
Well, I wanted to talk to you two particularly because I sort of follow you a little bit, you know, just in what you do. And you've done some of the most amazing things. And what's that song? In this lost and troubled world, we sometimes lose our way. I think we've lost our way.
Exactly.
But you've got good news stories, and we need some good news stories.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we've got lots of good news stories to talk with. Why don't you start with the Nature Festival?
Good-o. Well, as Chris has often remarked to people, it seems like it's one of the few places in the world, Adelaide, that holds an annual nature festival, and it's varied sort of things. There's presentations. We did a presentation on saving soil during it at Lock End House, but there's demonstrations of what people do both locally and, you know, maybe in projects in the rural areas as well, music and dance and everything, and a really vibrant sort of organizing committee, isn't it, Chris, that
yes.
sort of digs out good things that are happening, particularly in, you know, in nature-based improvements, shall we say. Chris, do you want to say
yes,
something?
Yes, and it's over the school holidays in springtime, and so it involves a lot of school kids. And they're going into the schools before they go on to the holidays, and to try and to get them involved in during that period to go on to these nature festival adventures during that their holidays, which has apparently been incredibly successful. So we're really quite committed to this idea of this almost unique situation of Nature Festival and promoting it wherever we can, because
it's a beautiful thing, isn't it? Because nature, we think about it as separate from us,
but
it involves us,
exactly.
And it's that interconnectedness of everything that it covered, like nature and music, bringing it together.
And it also draws upon some very concerning things. The United Nations has declared there's only 45 years of arable and cropland left in the world. So my focus lately has been through sort of permaculture ideas and my personal research into this area. So my focus at the moment is to trying to get people to understand we have this thin layer of soil that we have to build upon, otherwise it's going to be a worldwide disaster of cropland destruction.
What then?
What
happens then? Yes. And we've neglected this idea. We've seen it as dirt, something dirty, something we don't have to build upon. Recently, we were in Sydney, for instance, and everything goes into the general rubbish. And it was like really hurt us because, you know, we compost everything in our backyard. We have green bins for, you know, in our neighbourhood, which is very unique. And so we all this waste goes into the general waste up in, for a huge city like Sydney. What are we doing to build our soil?
Exactly. Mm. And you eat a lot of your own produce, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
A third of our own produce we grow. Yes. Yeah.
And even in this extreme drought period, which a lot of people aren't really understanding, because, of course, what's happened is that we don't have water restrictions at the moment, because in the upper reaches of the Murray and the Darling, there's been lots of rain, so there's lots of water to come out of the tap. But people don't understand, it's all coming from the Murray.
Mm.
There's nothing coming from the sky. I mean, it hasn't really rained since August at all. You know, a few drops here and there, but since August, nothing. You know, but it's still a little bit quite divorced probably from most people's understanding. Certainly there's lots of people that do understand it's a severe drought time, but, but there's I would say probably almost a majority of the populace don't really understand that. Yeah, and so, but back to the Nature Festival, I mean, you know, we're already in February trying to figure out, okay, what's the next little theme that would be nice for us to do, because we can't just, because we give a lot of public presentation, we can't just give the same thing over and over again. Because there's lots of things to focus upon, and as we say, lots of good news stories. We're not going to just talk about, you know, death and destruction. We want to promote people thinking that there are ways around a lot of the problems that we're seeing.
Yeah,
we can't just focus on horrible stuff.
Yeah. And at the moment, that's all we're fed.
That's how we're fed.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have to look at other things.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Nature Festival is a beautiful one to begin with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
one of the things that we might talk about this year, because it might go on to something else, because this is important too, because most people don't know about this scheme as well. We have a property at Monarto, which we've had for 40 years. We've got one of the National Endangered Species that we're curating there and basically saving it from extinction. It's 53 hectares. We applied two and a half years ago to get what is called a biodiversity credit scheme grant. Now, in some ways, there's some negative aspects to it, because people put money in, if they're clearing something, into this scheme, and we get the money out to improve other places. So it's a bit dubious in one respect.
Yeah.
But coupled with that, we've managed to get the whole property of the 53 hectares, except one little slice of a couple of hectares where a shed is and stuff, under permanent heritage agreement. Now, what the grant is for is to increase the biodiversity on the place, on the property, by 20% over 10 years, and only using local provenance plants. So that's very important. It's not just Australian native plants, it's plants
local.
And not just South Australian, it's like plants from the Monarto Plateau. And so it's really very special, and in fact we work in conjunction with another incredible project on there, formed by an organization called BioR, or Bioregeneration, formed by the Paytons, Penny and David Payton and their daughter Fiona, and involving lots of young people. There's a place on the Monarto Plateau called Franz Farm, and it's government land, crown land, I guess you could call it, and they've been working for years replanting up to 40,000 seedlings a year.
They have working bees, don't they?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of interesting things happening on that plateau.
Yeah. Mm. And on your property too, I remember some years ago we talked about your property at Monato,
yes.
And you were saying that you actually got more rainfall.
Yeah, well, in fact, one of my PhD students and I are just about to submit a paper about trends in rainfall and temperature in South Australia in agriculturally vulnerable regions,
uh-huh.
like the Murray Mallee and the Northern Eyre Peninsula. And to be perfectly honest, and we've looked at the science behind it, the atmospheric physics and stuff like this, but it would appear that around that plateau is the only place in South Australia where rainfall is actually increasing a bit.
And you've got all the data for that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And everywhere else it's decreasing, and of course the temperatures are rising everywhere. And so, you know, the combination of lower rainfall and higher temperatures make it, vulnerable areas of South Australia even more vulnerable.
Mm.
Okay? So it would appear that that's happening, and it would appear that it's got some connections with, you know, the increased vegetation from the plantings in the 1970s that were supposed to be for the Monarto city that, of course, fell through mm. and ended up with the overpopulation at Mount Parker instead.
Gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah.
Black roofs everywhere.
Yeah. Well, that as well, yes.
Yeah. As you say, you're proving that it can be done. And
yeah.
and that's so important. And how long do you think it actually took before the rainfall increased?
It was, well, the feeling is probably, you know, 15 to 20 years after
yeah.
the plantings began and stuff.
Yeah.
So. And, you know, and it was a prime sort of, it's just probably by accident, because, you know, the atmospheric physics stuff basically says something like, if you have vegetation and a slightly elevated position, which that plateau is elevated compared to, say, Callington and
yeah.
Murray Bridge, as an example, close to the sea, which it is, it's close to the sea, plus Lake Alexandria as well. So if you get breezes coming off the sea, bringing some moisture, and then they have to go up a small elevation, and there's evapotranspiration up on that elevated area, it adds to the total volume of the water moisture in the air and can produce clouds under the right conditions. I mean, that's the work of this atmospheric physicist that we're relying on to understand what may be happening, what seems to be happening. I mean, it's like a lot of things in statistical analysis, not proven, but you get an indication of what might be happening.
Have you been to Igawata
in
the Flinders Ranges?
Not necessarily. Where is that?
Yep.
Hawker?
Yeah, you go through Hawker.
Go through Hawker.
Yeah, there's Mount Searle, an old sheep station.
Yeah.
Well, they got that. They've got that under a. It wasn't the native title. It was a different.
Right.
The Aboriginal people were under Mount people.
Yes, I know where you mean now.
Yeah,
we drove through.
We've been through.
Yeah, we've been through.
On one side of like on their side of where Igawata actually is, which is Igawata is just edible tree.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that's the native orange.
Native orange.
Yes. We have
grown
some.
Yeah.
And we're growing some in our yard.
Yeah.
But they'd probably take 20 years before we
get
any.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They just got rid of the sheep.
Yeah.
They got rid of the sheep, and on one side there's sheep, and on the other side there's not sheep.
It's just amazing the
difference. Yes,
exactly.
Extraordinary.
The vegetation, everything.
Yeah.
Just and you walk on the land, it feels different.
If you get the sheep away, I mean, you can. It's amazing.
And the goats under control.
The seed bag that's in the ground is quite spectacular, and as soon as you get the grazing herbivores away or controlled, they've got a chance to come.
Yeah. We've got so much to talk about that this just absolutely excites me, because it's so good to hear news that says there's a future, there's a way to do this.
Yeah.
So you've been doing some travelling for work lately.
We certainly have. Like, last year was really amazing because John was involved with quite a few universities and conferences overseas. But we did combine it with a hot, great, marvellous holiday in Greece, where we've been going to the same village for over 40 years.
Oh, gorgeous.
And
which was recorded in our Gardening Australia segment as well, so about that particular village.
Where we actually got the ideas, this from this village, being there so often, we started to really look at why this small village in Crete was so, had the most amazing food, partly from the sea and then from the farmers up in the mountains. Nothing is wasted. All the there's chook farms just outside the cafes where all the waste goes. Yeah, it's even though it's changed a lot in 40 years, you can still see that love of the land and trying to, you know, the Mediterranean. We learned a lot about the growing Mediterranean plants from being in that village for holidays over that long period of time. And we think we've been there? About eight or something?
Six, I think.
Yes, yeah. And a lot of that time we're just observing what's going on in that place.
And looking at the agriculture production around the place and stuff. Because if you actually look at it, the climate in Crete and Sicily in particular, if you look at the climate there, it's a mirror image of the climate here.
Mm.
So in the sense that, because that's northern hemisphere, this is southern hemisphere, we have, you know, winter and summer different times from them, but they have cool, wet winters and hot, dry summers.
Yeah.
And what do we have? Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully we get another cool, wet winter, because we haven't had one last year. Yeah, and when we're saying about travelling, well, one of the things that I did attend, or two of the things are related to a story that most South Australians don't know about and should. One was an International Energy Agency meeting in Denmark, and the other was a conference I was invited to in December in China. And in both places, well, particularly the China one, I was talking about South Australia as the world leader in electricity from what are called variable renewable energy sources, or VRE. So it's not like it's a big dam like the Three Gorges Dam in China or something like that. It's sources that are variable over time, like wind and solar. Okay, and the two places that have reached next to highest level in the International Energy Agency framework or set of phases of integration of VREs into the electricity system are Denmark and South Australia and nobody else. Okay, nobody's hit the top level, which is firm power from renewables every minute of the day. Okay, but the next level below that is large amounts of excess electricity from renewables over the year. Excess meaning more than the demand, okay? Which will allow us, when the good interconnector with Sydney, when it is completed, we'll be able to send off electricity to New South Wales at a time, because of geographical differences, at a time when they have peak demand in the evening, early evening in summertime, and we're still generating solar because of the geographical difference. And so why are we better than Denmark? Well, Denmark has great interconnection with Norway, Germany, and Scotland even, with undersea cables, so that if the wind isn't blowing in Denmark, because they get almost all their renewables from wind, both onshore and offshore, If the wind isn't blowing, they can get 100% of their maximum demand from other countries. You know, and they'll bank that stuff
right.
too.
Yeah,
so that
yeah.
when they've got excess, they'll send it off to Norway to pump water uphill into dams waiting for hydro
yeah.
electricity to be generated when it's needed in Norway and also in Denmark when they have lower supply than demand. Whereas in South Australia, because we've got at the moment not that good interconnection with Victoria only really, maybe a little bit with New South Wales, but not much, we can only get 25% of our maximum demand. Now, one of the good things about that in many respects is that Albert Einstein said that crises build opportunities. So if you can't get all your demand from somewhere else, if you've got to generate it yourself, okay, and we don't have any coal-fired power stations in South Australia, we only have renewables and peaking gas, and some other innovative features which the local distribution network people, SAPN, have worked on to make sure that things are pretty stable. And in fact, we've even had cases when we've been totally cut off for a couple of months from any interconnection at all, and it's still worked.
Why don't people know more about this?
I don't know. It's interesting. It's not like... Sometimes governments forget to tell some of the good news stories.
Yeah.
You know, they talk about ramping and stuff like this, and, you know, the focus is on that. And sometimes, once again, you got to remember how the political process works. You have the opposition, whoever it might be, harping on what's wrong with what the government's doing.
Yeah.
And so they sometimes set the agenda rather than the government trying to set their own agenda. But even sometimes, if they have a good opportunity, they don't necessarily always take it.
Mm.
So once again, I've given that talk in many different forms, including at a weird one last week, the Thursday Thinkers Lunch in the city in Hutt Street, and it was supposedly the biggest crowd they ever had for the lunch. So people are interested.
Mm.
So we've got to tell these stories.
Absolutely, we've got to tell these stories.
And I said it I gave it at the Raising the Bar night in Norwood Paynham and St. Peter's Council last year.
So what's Raising the Bar?
Okay, so Raising the Bar, they set up one night in August where they have bars, pubs, whatever, clubs, and they have two speakers at each club, each place, location, and they just invite... Say people come along for that night, sign up, blah blah blah, and it was really a good night. It was at a little place in Stepney. I gave that talk, or you know, a version of it, and also there was a nutritionist from UniSA talking about the Mediterranean diet. So it was a great sort of interplay, really, and we actually had the whole place sold out, which was really good. So, yeah. And, you know, so it happens every year, set up by the Norwood Paynham St. Peter's Council, and it's a really great event. You know, once again, there's some really great events around. I mean, we've got, all the talks as well at WOMAC coming up as well.
Absolutely. And there's pretty interesting ones in Writers Week too.
And Writers Week as well.
Busy time coming up.
Oh, we can sleep in April.
Yeah.
So, have we covered what you did in Streaky Bay?
So, we've sold our place in Tummy Bay, but that was a really interesting experience because we were... The first people on was going to be an eco village at Modra Apartments in Tumby Bay. So we got in on the ground level, if you like, and to build the first place. But unfortunately, the owner of that land had some health problems, and eventually it was sold. But for 3.5 years, we had going over there through COVID. and staying in an eight star house, and it really was amazing how a passive house can work with the right design. And we can actually say that we had an amazing experience being the first people to we'd always wanted to do something like this, and this was a golden opportunity, and we've passed it on to people who now are new owners, but they absolutely love that place, and it's part of their rental place now, and as a luxury a place to stay on the with the other apartments that are available for hire.
And you know, it's good because it is, though the whole Echo Village didn't get off the ground, it's still a great example of what can be done, as Chris was saying. And so even when people come in and rent it for a few days or something like this, they can still experience how simple design processes can make a huge difference.
Is it all off-grid?
No, it's part. It's connected, but basically it's net positive in terms of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there'll be more energy flowed off to the grid than flows in, mm-hmm. because, you know, once again, if you got a really cloudy day, it's only solar,
yeah.
you know, because it's on the house. If you got a really cloudy day, you might have to get some from the grid that day,
yeah.
but other days you'll be sending heaps to the grid. And I mean, that's the same position that we are in. In Felixstowe, because we've got 3.5 kilowatts, well, maybe 4 kilowatts, because we've got an old part of the system as well. 4 kilowatts of solar plus a battery, and, you know, over the year, we're net positive in electricity because we send more to the grid than we get. That's the whole thing, you know, that's what people mean by net zero. And I mean, when we talk about in South Australia, now this is another good story. In South Australia, the goal was to be 100% electricity averaged over the year, right? Not at every specific moment, but over the year from renewables, okay? Well, things are happening so fast that they've had to change that. It's going to be 2027 instead of 2030. So it's going too fast, and it's going to arrive at the 100% before it was... before the goal, shall we say? So the goalposts move.
Why don't they talk about that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I say it's net over the year, because as I mentioned before, at really good times for us generating and big demand in the eastern states, we'll be sending lots there. But once in a while, we have to bring some back because, you know, because the geographical diversity helps. And the technical diversity as well. So you've got wind and solar put all around the place. You're going to get lots of smoothing of the effects, shall we say.
So this is all really quite wonderful.
I think probably just about the home stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, can you talk about the Kurrajongtree?
Oh, right, yes.
As well, but yeah.
So we've lived in our house nearly 30 years. And when it was like a little weatherboard house, and eventually we had to rebuild a third of the house because of white ants.
Also there was asbestos cladding on the outside, so we had to get rid of that.
But once again,
it was an opportunity because before we put the next cladding on, we could fill all the walls with insulation.
Yeah.
And when we had the termite damage, we could fill the interior walls with insulation as well, so we could zone the place.
And the place was an absolute disaster when we moved in, and I was actually quite depressed about it at first until I sort of got my head into gear and thinking, this is an opportunity. So there was old shares, there was junk, there was concrete.
Lots of concrete.
Broken up concrete, there was... just old tanks, you name it. It took us really 2 years to clean that up.